Welcome to Tim Friedman's 70s Rock Conversations. I'm your host, Tim Friedman, joined by Frank Ost, our local rock and roll expert. Frankie, welcome.
Thank you, and it's great to be here.
We've been waiting to do Jimi Hendrix as our featured artist for quite some time. We're going to do that one today.
Great.
So, today in rock history is where we begin. June 27th, the day before your birthday.
Exactly.
And my lovely daughter, Michelle. 1959, on June 27th, Frankie, the musical play West Side Story closed on Broadway after 734 performances.
Wow, isn't that neat?
That is. 1968, Elvis performed live in what was billed as his comeback special, that small square stage of his, you know, surrounded mostly by females in the audience, and he wore that famous black leather outfit. Good comeback.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
There was a time there I didn't think he was going to come back, and I was a really young buck at the time, but I knew who he was, but I hadn't seen him for years.
No, and he was kind of the generation before us, to be honest with you.
Do you know a group named Smile? It was an English group.
No.
1970, they officially changed their name to a name you would know, Queen.
Oh, well, there you go. That's why I didn't know.
The Fillmore East in New York City closed on this date in 1971. Their final performance featured Country Joe McDonald, which makes sense, Edgar Winter, the Beach Boys,
wow,
and the Allman Brothers Band. That definitely makes sense.
Yes.
MCA Records purchased Motown for $61 million in 1988. And a year later, The Who played the rock opera Tommy in its entirety for the first time in 17 years.
Okay. Yeah, I once saw them do that here right at Cleveland Municipal Stadium.
Wow. Now, if you were at Radio City Music Hall in New York City, you would have seen it in 1989. Tom Jones honored with a star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame in the state in 1989 as well. Lyle Lovett and Julia Roberts were married in 1993 and divorced 2 years later. Hollywood marriages just don't work
all the time, do they? Not many.
John Entwistle, The Who's bassist, was found dead in his hotel room of an apparent heart attack in Las Vegas in 2002. He was just 57 years old.
That's incredible.
You know, some of these guys, I think, are just going to live forever. And then some guys just die so young.
Exactly. And you never know exactly how long they're going to be with us. So if you have somebody that you want to see them now.
Yeah. Birthdays, Helen Keller, 1880. Captain Kangaroo, Bob Keeshan, remember him?
Absolutely.
Bunny Rabbit, Mr. Green Jeans.
Mm-hmm.
Dancing Bear was my favorite. That show on CBS in the morning ran from 1955 to 84.
Wow.
Entertaining,
I didn't realize it went that long.
Generations of young kids like you and me.
Sure.
He played the original Clarabelle the Clown on the Howdy Doody show.
Oh, I'll be darned.
Captain Kangaroo,
I remember that show too. Yeah. Barely, but I do remember it.
You know Frank Mills, the music box dancer? He's 80 years old today.
Really? Okay.
And Bruce Johnston, Beach Boys.
Yeah, you know,
he
sure.
He wrote I Write the Songs. He's 80 today. Won a Grammy Award for that big Barry Manilow hit in 1976.
Mm-hmm.
Julia Duffy, you know, she played on New Heart and also on
The
Dining
Woman. Housekeeper, wasn't she? Yeah.
I think her name was Stephanie or something.
Yeah.
She was nominated for a Primetime Emmy Award 7 times over the years when she was on New Heart and Designing Women. Never won, though. She lost to Rhea Perlman of Cheers, Carla.
Oh, absolutely.
The bartender.
Yeah.
Carla won 4 times.
I'll be darned.
So every year, I wonder after a while if Julia said, you know what, I'm going to skip it this year. And actor Tobey Maguire, Spider-Man, and he was also one of the, you know, Jockey and Seabiscuit.
Sure.
1975. All right, Frankie, time for Concert Calendar, and we've got some good shows coming up. This Saturday, we'll be at the Bare Naked Ladies Toad the Wet Sprocket Gin Blossom Show at Nautica Stage. That's Saturday, July 2nd, as part of the big 4th of July weekend. Doobie Brothers, 50th anniversary plus one. The tour comes to Blossom on July 12th. A week later, Rod Stewart and Cheap Trick at Blossom on the 19th. A couple of great shows, Saturday the 30th, Earth, Wind & Fire, MGM Center Stage. And at Progressive Field, same night, Elton John's Farewell Yellow Brick Road Tour. The Al Stewart Concert rescheduled for August 17th, a Wednesday night at Kent Stage. Al DiMeola, the guitar great, part of the 20th anniversary celebration at Kent Stage. Sunday, September 11th, and a new show just announced recently, Chaka Khan. What is she, a 7-time Rock Hall nominee? She'll be at the MGM Center Stage Sunday, November the 5th. New category of ours, Frankie, deep cuts from top albums. This comes from the 7-time platinum album, 52nd Street.
That's right, yeah.
Grammy winner also for Album of the Year. It's a song called Zanzibar, or as he calls it, Zanzibar. It's one of the songs he plays still to this day at his concerts when he was at Progressive Field probably 3-4 years ago. My wife and I were there. He played it. It's a great song.
Okay.
It comes on side one. And it's the final track on side one, because we're talking about albums, you know.
Sure.
Kind of reminds me of a quicker version of scenes from an Italian restaurant.
Mm-hmm, sure.
This time it's scenes from a smoky bar, you know, somewhere in New Jersey or something like that.
Yeah, a little piano man action.
Yeah,
actually.
Right.
Yeah.
Late in a Friday night or something like
sure.
that. Zanzibar by Billy Joel from 52nd Street.
Nice.
You have a good one, too.
Yeah, this is Getting in Tune by The Who from Who's Next. As I've said before, Who's Next is my favorite classic rock album. So it makes sense that I would have a deep cut from this one locked and ready to go. This song kicks off side two, starting the momentum that will peak with Won't Get Fooled Again. The song's lyrics begin by noting that the singer really doesn't have anything to say. Rather, he claims that I'm singing this note because it fits in well with the chords I'm playing. The lyrics reflect the contradictions Townsend was feeling between his desire for spirituality and self-understanding against his persona as a hard-drinking, hard-partying rock star. The music begins with session musician Nicky Hopkins playing a gentle tune on the piano, while John Entwistle plays bass. Then Roger Daltrey sings the opening line softly, but explodes on the line, "I'm gonna tune right in on you," supported by Keith Moon's drum fills.
So that album was released, Who's Next, in August of 71.
Right.
What do you like most about that album?
Well, a couple things. Number one, it's such a strong album as far as the tracks on it. There's not a loser track on there. There's no tracks that you have to, you know, push,
skip past,
yeah. Take the needle and put it up, and mm-hmm. you can just
daydream, and you know,
set the needle down, yeah. and you listen to it from front to back. And of course, it ends up with "We Won't Get Fooled Again," which is again one of my favorite songs in the world. Yeah.
So, what do you think made Pete Townshend's songwriting better at that time? I know they had done Tommy. You know,
sure.
but they came out of the My Generation and the Magic Bus and stuff, and then they kind of shifted into stuff that really fit the 70s, didn't they? Pete Townshend
right.
with that songwriting was fantastic, wasn't he?
Yeah, and in fact, most of Who's Next was supposed to be another concept album called Lifehouse, and the whole thing kind of got blown to heck, and after Tommy, they were just looking for something, and of course, the record company was going, hey, we need something from you now, so he kind of took some of what was left from there and wrote a few more songs, and suddenly there was Who's Next, which was, you know, a happy accident.
Do you think that the record company was upset with them to the point maybe they were going to think about dropping them, or were they
I don't think so. I don't think it would be foolish at that, particularly after they just really broken through with Tommy. It would have been foolish for them to drop them, but I'm sure the pressure was on, hey, we need product now.
Yeah.
And boy, did they get some.
We're going to talk about the pressure being on with our brand new category pretty soon. Great Start Then, ..
Yeah.
We're going to talk about Don McLean pretty soon, who came out with that American Pie album from the same year, late 71. You know,
but sure, exactly.
About how hard it is to follow up.
Definitely.
And so we'll be hitting that in just a few minutes. So, Frankie, thanks. That's a good one from you for Deep Cuts from Top Albums this week. New topic, Great Starts, Then, .. I know, ellipses, but it's kind of hard to say. We have Don McLean, the native of New Rochelle, New York, which was actually the home of Dick Van Dyke. Remember him and Mary Tyler Moore?
That's how I knew
Laura.
The town of New Rochelle, because I looked, literally, when I was a kid, I looked it up on a map, see where the heck it was.
Yeah, and
it's just north of the Bronx, actually.
Yeah, take the train out of the city, which everybody did. So.
Sure.
But what do you have about Don McLean? I know, you know, he got up to such a great start.
Well, you know, he's best known for his 1971 song, American Pie, an 8.5-minute folk rock cultural touchstone about the loss of innocence of the early rock and roll generation. Now, this was his second album, his first one called Tapestry. Didn't do too well. Had a little bit of commercial success, but not a whole lot. He came up with the idea for the American Pie album from Sgt. Pepper's, which was obviously a concept album. So he feels that American Pie is the same way. It's a concept album. Everything kind of goes together. Ever wondered about the Chevy to the Levee line?
No, never.
Well,
not me. I might be the only American who does, but
you know, I always wondered about it, but. Early in the 1960s, the Levee was a popular bar hangout right across from Iona Prep, from which Don McLean graduated in 1963.
Oh, wow.
It is said that the Levee was the bar McLean drove to. It was closed, so he drove to the Mug Ale House in Rye, New York. Get it? Drinking whiskey
and
rye.
Yeah.
Where rumor has it, he sat in a booth and wrote the iconic tune.
All at once?
Yeah.
All 8 minutes plus?
Well, you know, that's the story. I mean,
did you have the single?
You got to have a story. No, I never had the single. To be honest with you, I was never a big fan of the song to go out and like buy the album or buy the single. And of course, back in the day, you could hear it on the radio just about any time you wanted.
Yeah. He was on the United Artists label, which you know, Bill Conti of Gonna Fly Now.
Oh, sure.
A lot of soundtrack stuff. So I'm not quite sure how they hooked up with him, but I could see where after a while, especially after a couple albums, follow-up albums that maybe didn't do so well, he might have been better on tour, they got impatient and just said, well, you know, he's not really our kind of musician anyway. Maybe we'll just kind of drop him. I don't know.
Exactly.
How record companies are.
Now, what's interesting about McLean is that he made the Songwriters Hall of Fame in 2004 based on this one album, American Pie.
Wow.
Or should I say two songs? But what songs they were. American Pie has over 5 million airplays. And Vincent, Starry, Starry Night, has over 3 million.
Starry, starry night, Paint your palette blue and gray. Look out on a summer's day with eyes that know the darkness in my soul. Shadows on the hills. Sketch the trees and the daffodils. Catch the breeze and the winter chills in colors on the snowy linen land. Now I understand what you tried to say to me, and how you suffered for your sanity, and how you tried to set them free. They would not listen, they did not know how. Perhaps they'll listen now. Starry, starry night.
Now just imagine that, on one album, two songs, that played on the radio. Like I said, you could hear it just about any time you wanted to.
You know, I don't have the album. I wanted to get it because the album cover is really cool.
But yeah, with the thumb, yeah, yes.
I'd be hard-pressed to find another song on there that I know. Maybe Castles in the Air or something?
Right, exactly.
Quick, does anybody know any other cuts on the American Pie album? Because I don't.
And I rarely know any of his other songs. I know he did have a hit with Roy Orbison's Crying towards the end of the 70s.
That was a while later.
Exactly.
Castles in the Air. And
yeah, there were a few. His future albums did not match the commercial success of American Pie, but he did become a major concert attraction across the United States and overseas. Now, his repertoire includes old concert hall numbers and catalogs of such singers as Buddy Holly, well, that makes sense, and Frank Sinatra. The years spent playing gigs in small clubs and coffee houses in the 60s have transformed into well-paced performances.
Yeah, you know, he's got a 35-day tour planned for later on this year, starting in September in Europe, so he's not going to come here. But it's going to end in November, so he's got a lot of dates ahead of him. He's 76 years old now and still really has it in concert. The website looks good. His Don McLean website, you can get all kinds of swag and find out all about tour dates and stuff.
Yeah, because unlike a group like the Stones or Genesis, there's no need for him to put on a show. He walks out on stage, has guitar, let's go. Maybe he has a few musicians with him, but there's not a lot of pressure on him to do anything. He doesn't have to slink around the stage or anything like that.
Best Instrumentals category, Frankie. For me, it's the theme from Taxi, Angela's theme. Remember Taxi, the show that ran mainly on ABC from 78 to 83. The last year it was on NBC.
Mm-hmm.
But Angela was a character who played alongside Judd Hirsch's character, you know, Alex Rieger. I guess they went out or something, and she was kind of overweight.
Okay.
You know, and then they brought her back a couple years later, and she had lost weight.
Oh.
So Angela was the name of the third episode. Bob James, the famous jazz keyboardist and arranger, composer, put the song together. It's a slower song, and it shows a yellow taxi driving over the Queensboro Bridge.
Yes,
you can picture it now, can't you?
I sure can.
The driver of that cab is actually actor Tony Danza.
Really?
Thank you.
It wasn't on like 9:30. Didn't that one of those? Right after
Barney Miller, or exactly. just before Barney yeah. Miller, something yeah. like that on ABC. One of my favorite shows of all time.
Sure.
You know, the original album it was off of was called Touchdown, which only, as a jazz album would, only has like four or five cuts, right? Touchdown's a much more up-tempo song, and producers wanted that to be the opening theme as credits, the title credits rolled. But they liked the sound of Taxi Evangelist theme better, so they made that the theme and just kind of switched it up on at the end, as producers can do, right?
Right,
James L. Brooks
right.
and those guys. You know that Bob James was discovered by Quincy Jones.
It makes total sense, because Quincy Jones was in action in the early 60s.
This is like 1963
yeah.
when he started exactly. out. When Bob started out, he was discovered while playing at a talent show. Bob was at the Notre Dame Collegiate Jazz Festival, which judges were heavyweights, Quincy Jones and Henry Mancini.
Nice.
So one of the two is going to, you know, find him. He won several Grammys, been nominated for at least a dozen others.
Yeah, when I think of him, I think of like George Benson.
That's
that time period, you know.
Yep.
A lot of good things happening.
He's worked with so many great titans of the jazz industry: Larry Carlton, Sarah Vaughan, Maynard Ferguson,
absolutely,
Earl Klug,
yeah.
Grover Washington Jr. That's just to name a few. So the song is called Angela's Theme, better known as the theme from Taxi.
Right.
And of course, if you have the DVD set like I do, only it's four or five seasons long, so it's not like it's gonna like MASH or Friends or something like that.
Sure.
It's certainly worth listening to, and certainly you can download it as well if you don't already have it in your file there. Angela's Theme, the theme from Taxi, it's Bob James.
Perfect.
How about you? What do you have?
The Nut Rocker by Emerson, Lake and Palmer. Now, this is an instrumental rock song, first recorded by American instrumental ensemble B. Bumble and the Stingers. And it reached number 23 here in the U.S. In March of 62, it went to number one in the U.K. from Tchaikovsky's ballet, The Nutcracker, that was adopted by pop impresario Kim Fowley, who we've mentioned on this show a number of times. It has the odd songwriting team of Pyotr Ilyich Tchaikovsky and Kim Fowley. The version I love is by ELP, Emerson, Lake and Palmer, and it's the perfect encore for their live album, Pictures at an Exhibition. It's a super up-tempo version with Emerson banging away on the clavinet, Lake romping on the bass and exhorting the crowd, and Carl Palmer even taking a quick manic drum solo, and ends the show the only way possible.
Which sounds something like Emerson, Lake, and Palmer would do. Something
absolutely.
From Tchaikovsky and others.
Yeah, I had never heard the version. I have now heard the version of B. Bumble and the Stingers. So I know where they got their idea. But boy, I just remember hearing that. Pictures at an Exhibition was another one my sister brought home from school. And boy, I just love that thing.
Now, B. Bumble and the Stingers, not to be confused with Flight of the Bumblebee, right?
That's right.
Released in November of 71 was
right.
the album, produced, as were many, produced by Greg Lake.
Sure.
So what do you think gets a group like Emerson, Lake and Palmer? A lot of these guys, you know, were classical musicians as kids.
Yeah, definitely. Keith
and know how to play and know all the Strauss and Tchaikovsky and Beethoven. What do you think actually makes them want to put something together like this?
I don't know. I'm not sure where they came up with their ideas. I know that other bands had just started to do kind of the classical crossover. There are other bands doing it. In fact, one of the very earliest ones was Blue Oyster Cult, mm-hmm. of all people, who'd actually did a concerto for a rock band and classical orchestra. So it was going on, and, you know, Emerson, Lake, and Palmer, like they did, took it and just ran with it and just made it bigger than life. And that's what the Nut Rocker is. Did the same thing with Fanfare for the Common Man. A lot of things like that. Yeah.
So the Nut Rocker from ELP, a far cry from the theme from Taxi, Angela's theme from Bob James.
Totally different. One's just a full-out rocker, and the other is kind of bittersweet.
Is not. Psychedelic versus Pop, we're going back to the week of September 21st, 1968. That's Jimi Hendrix at number 66. That's the psychedelic category, believe it or not.
That's right.
And you have?
All Along the Watchtower.
Must be some kind of way out of here, said a joker to the thief. There's too much confusion, I can't get no relief. Businessman there, drink my wine, plowman dig my earth.
Now this track brings together two of the most important figures of 1960s music, writer Bob Dylan and guitar player Jimi Hendrix. Hendrix was fascinated with Dylan and one day brought to the studio a bunch of tapes of songs that he had been working on. That led to the recording session for his favorite, All Along the Watchtower. According to Hendrix's regular engineer, Eddie Kramer, the final bass part was played by Hendrix himself. His friend and Rolling Stones multi-instrumentalist Brian Jones plays the various percussion instruments on the track. Dylan has described his reaction to hearing Hendrix's version as follows. It overwhelmed me, really. He had such a talent. He could find things inside a song and vigorously develop them. He found things that other people wouldn't even think of finding in there. He probably improved upon it by the spaces he was using. I took license with the song from his version, actually, and continue to do so to this day.
Yeah, you know, it debuted at number 66 on this date, September 21st, 1968, at number 66. So that's
right.
Saying something right there. It would top out at number 20. It's a few weeks later. It was his highest charting single for Jimi Hendrix.
Yeah, he didn't have a lot of chart toppers. So, yeah, it was big. At least he got a little bit of play on the AM radio station.
I've seen the movie Forrest Gump, of course.
Mm-hmm.
Just when they're arriving in country and the helicopter, they only play the first couple of measures or bars or whatever.
Dun, 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 dun.
Of course, they played more, but so it doesn't appear on the soundtrack, which is awesome, which I have, but All Along the Watchtower took a little while for me to find it, because back then you couldn't just Google things.
No, definitely not.
Get asked
there
somebody.
Was no YouTube or anything, yeah.
My 4-year-old daughter wasn't quite aware of Jimi Hendrix and Electric Ladyland at the time. So Jimi Hendrix, All Along the Watchtower, was number 66. That's our psychedelic. Number 65 is...
The city streets you used to walk along with me. And every step I take recalls how much in love we used to be. Oh, how can I forget you when there is always something there to remind me? Always something there to remind me.
And not the Naked Eyes version from 1983, but the one from Dion, There's Always Something There to Remind Me. And she had a whole string of hits, Message
she
to
sure
Michael,
did, yeah.
And Way to San Jose and whatever.
San Jose, and yes.
This Girl's in Love with You, we've had her in our psychedelic versus pop category a couple of times now. When in Wonder Time, Frankie, love grows where my rosemary goes. Mm. The Edison Lighthouse, not Lighthouse. Of One Fine Morning fame.
Sure.
But Love Grows by the Edison Lighthouse, an early 1970, a number 5 hit. Yeah, studio group from England. A lot of studio groups back then. You know who their lead singer was? Tony Burrows.
The
Beach
famous.
Baby and My Baby Loves Lovin' and United We Stand, Gimme That Ding.
Yep.
So Love Grows reached number 5 the week of April 17th, 1970. That's my mother's birthday.
Nice.
She was 41 years old that day.
Oh my gosh.
Let It Be was number 1. It's like number 1 for forever.
Of course.
Love Grows is a million-selling single. It would only stay at that spot for 1 week at number 5. Before beginning its inevitable fall off the charts. But don't worry, because Tony Burrows' next song, Gimme That Ding by the Pipkins, would take over, debuting that week in the Hot 100 at number 65, about like a month later, I should say.
Exactly. So. Oh, man.
Good tune, though, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a fun tune. You know, it's one of those that kind of sticks in your head once you hear it. Yeah.
An earworm.
Exactly.
It's a nice bouncy song from the Edison Lighthouse. Our two-hit wonder comes from the main ingredient, Everybody Plays the Fool.
Oh, I remember that one.
Number 3 in the fall of 72. Good music out in the fall of 72. Honky Cat, Black and White.
Okay, so your heart broke. You sit around moping, crying, crying. You say you even thinking about dying? Well, before you do anything rash, dig this. Everybody plays a fool sometime. There's no exception to the rule. Listen, baby. It may be factual, maybe cruel. I'm lying. Everybody plays a fool. Ooh. Falling in love is such an easy thing to do. And there's no guarantee that the one you love is gonna love you. Than any ocean, it clouds your mind with emotion.
Just Don't Want to Be Lonely was the other big hit of theirs, number 10 in 1974. Not as familiar with that one.
Right, but I do remember it also, yeah.
Hey, say, wait a minute. Where are you going with that suitcase? Hey, wait a minute, listen. All right, well, you don't have to answer. Just listen. I don't mind when you say that you're going away. I just don't want to be lonely. And I don't care if we share.
Oh,
Two top 10 hits for this cool R&B group from Harlem, New York.
Nice.
Formed in 1964, they had a number of single releases from 70 to 75, including Everybody Plays the Fool, which peaked at number 3 the week of October 14th, 1972. Ben, song about the rat by Michael Jackson.
Oh, yeah.
It's number 1 at the time. And Bill Withers' Use Me was number 2 that
Boy,
week.
Boy, I can hear them all.
They'd released Just Don't Want to Be Lonely in early February 74, a top out at number 10 for the week of May 4th, 1974. Locomotion, Grand Funk Railroad,
sure.
was number 1 that week.
Our pal Mark Farner.
Yeah. main ingredient, 2-hit wonder, and our 1-hit wonder was Love Grows. Top 5 singles, the week of June 27th, 1971. This comes from the Bible.
My Billboard birthday Hot 100. Week.
Yeah. That's right, your birthday week. You would have been, what, 15 mm-hmm. years old? Listening to these songs up from number 6 the week before. I sound like Casey Kasem, don't I?
Yeah, you do.
The number 5 hit was Treat Her Like a Lady. You got to treat her like Cornelius Brothers and
sure,
Sister Rose.
Sister Rose, yeah.
Indian Reservation, The Lament, you know,
sure.
has up 3 notches from last week, or The Raiders. The Honeycombs had 1 ads, number 3.
I remember that one, sure.
Rainy Days and Mondays, Carpenters, that was at number 2 for the second week in a row.
Mm-hmm.
And Carole King, It's Too Late, was number 1.
Boy.
So the 2 straight weeks there, the number 1, 2, and 3 songs were all the same. 1 ads, Rainy Days, and It's Too Late.
Stayed in bed all morning just to pass the time. There's something wrong here, there can be no denying. One of us is changing, or maybe we just stop trying. And it's too
If you think about it, all of them had female singers, so the females were really kind of taking over at that point.
And the summer of 71 brought a lot of rainy songs. Rainy Days and Mondays, Here Comes a Rainy Day Feeling, Riders on the Storm.
Mm-hmm, sure.
Rock releases the week of June 27th, Xanadu soundtrack.
Oh, we've released. Talked about that one before.
1980. Caribou, Elton John, 1974.
That was a good one.
8 years later, Pictures at 11, that's Robert Plant.
Sure.
He'll be one of our featured artists. Plant will be very soon. Traffic had John Barleycorn Must Die in 1970. Ooh. Do you have that one?
Great record. Yes, I have it. I had it as an album, and then I have it as a CD. So
yeah, some good albums coming out in the summer of years gone by. At Fillmore East, the classic by the Allman Brothers
mm-hmm.
came out a year later. 1972, Doobie Brothers and Tallulah Street.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Life and Times, Jim Croce, 1973. Four by Foreigner. Thank goodness they came out with that album. I was really getting tired of Foreigner at that point.
Sure.
The Stadium Arena Band, you know, REO Speedwagon, Styx, Journey, Foreigner. And Foreigner would have been my least of the favorites at that point.
Probably, yeah.
I was tired of Cold as Ice and Double Vision and Head Games.
Exactly.
We needed something different. Al Stewart and Year of the Cat.
Oh, that's a good one.
Produced by Alan Parsons.
I'll never forget seeing him just as that thing broke over at Case. It was quite a concert, quite a show.
Yeah, that was released in 1976 in July. I thought it might have been released closer to 77, but no. And Waiting for the Sun by the Doors in 1968.
Oh, good one.
Good Rock releases the week of June 27th, just before your birthday. Featured artist Time Frankie, Jimi Hendrix. Born Johnny Allen Hendrix, November 27th, 1942, and died way too young.
Oh, absolutely.
September 18th, 1970, he's only 27. In England, what did you think of Jimi Hendrix the day he died? It was shocking to me, and I was only 10 years old and not a huge fan.
No, and I didn't know that much about him. I was, you know, only about 13, yeah. Maybe something like that. So 13 or 14, and didn't have any of his albums or anything like that. I wouldn't discover him until, you know, a few years later.
How about now? You have any of his albums,
oh,
CDs?
Yeah, definitely. And I love the way he played guitar. It's just genius.
I don't think anybody's
way.
Better.
No, I've never heard a better one. And it's not only the way he played guitar, but the fact that he had so much to say. There's that great line that Robert Fripp had about him where he said, you know, I can talk as well as Jimmy can talk. I just don't have that much to say.
Mm-hmm.
And if you understand what he's saying there, that he could probably play all the notes that Jimi Hendrix could play. But he couldn't play them like Hendrix did because Hendrix had so much fire inside of him.
And his interpretation, like Bob Dylan said about All Along the Watchtower,
exactly.
Second to none.
Exactly.
I'd put him in the same category, guitarists on this level. You know, Eric Clapton. I like Eddie Van Halen. I think he's phenomenal. How about other guitarists that you would also put in that kind of class, the pantheon?
The people I think of are like Carlos Santana.
Oh, yeah.
And lesser known would be Jeff Beck, mm-hmm. who, you know, seemed to kind of follow everybody like Page and all those through his career. But he is a tremendous player. And, of course, Jimmy Page.
Stevie Ray Vaughan, were you a big fan of his too?
Yeah, absolutely. And he's another one that left us far too early, yeah. And I think he had a lot more to say.
After all the jets are in the boxes and the clowns all gone to bed, you can hear happiness staggering on down the street. Footprints dressed in red, and the wind whispers clearly. A broom is drearily of the broken pieces of yesterday's life. Somewhere a queen is weeping. Somewhere a king has no wife.
Jimi Hendrix Experience was inducted into the Rock Hall in 1992. Other inductees that year, they had a good group. The Yardbirds, Sam and Dave, Johnny Cash, Booker T and the MGs, and the Isley Brothers, all inducted in 1992. And he was inducted by Neil Young. Interesting choice.
Yeah, very interesting choice. You know, obviously the recipient in this case wasn't around to choose, but definitely, you know, I don't think of Neil Young as a great guitar player. I think he's a great songwriter, but he can barely, as far as I'm concerned, play the damn guitar. If you've ever listened to some of his solos, you'll know what I mean. So it's very odd that he would be the choice, but he also kind of had that fire, so maybe it was a good choice.
What do you think of Jimi Hendrix vocals as a vocalist?
I know that he hated his vocals and literally would make them, you know, he would go off in a room by himself and not let anybody watch him sing a lot of times. So he didn't like his vocals. I thought they were perfectly fine for what he was doing and the fantastic guitar playing that he was doing. He didn't need to, you know, sound like Elvis Presley.
Yeah.
There was no need for Elvis.
And there's only one of him.
Exactly.
Rolling Stone ranked Jimi Hendrix the best guitarist of all time, sixth greatest artist of all time. Now, they change their lists all the time,
yeah,
but
exactly.
I imagine that it's going to stay number one, Jimi Hendrix, forever.
I cannot see that changing unless something changes in music where suddenly we have something like rock, but in another realm, say. And I can't even think that what that would be, but, you know, I mean, obviously, I'm projecting out hundreds of years from now. Maybe somebody will come up with something, and there'll be a guitar player that will top him. I don't know. I know there are other guitar players that can do the kind of things he did, but again, can they do what he did and have the burning desire to say it? You know, that's
yeah.
the incredible
thing.
And
in such thing. A small period of time, too.
I know. That's he only made 4 albums in his lifetime.
Mm-hmm.
4 albums that he actually sat down and said, I like what's on here. I'm putting it out.
Putting it out.
Those literally hundreds of albums that came after were not his doing, you know, they were other people.
May 1967, Are You Experienced? 5-time platinum.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, Joe, where you going with that gun in your hand? Shoot my old lady. You know I caught her messing around with
Number two, UK. He wrote all the tracks, Foxy Lady, Hey Joe, Purple Haze, you know, Axis Bold is Love, Platinum, number six in the U.S., number five UK, also 1967, but in December, so perfect for Christmas.
Sure.
You can get your hands on it then. A year later, October, Electric Ladyland, two-time platinum, number one here, number six over there. Double album and the only one produced by Jimi Hendrix.
Right.
That had All Along the Watchtower, Crosstown Traffic, a 15-minute almost version of Voodoo Child.
Yeah.
Dave Mason played 12-string guitar and also provided backing vocals on Crosstown Traffic and All Along the Watchtower. And Steve Winwood
That's
played
right.
the Hammond organ on one of the cuts, too. So, you know, from Traffic and all
sure,
that.
Sure, sure.
All three of these were released on the Reprise label, founded in 1960 by Frank Sinatra.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah, you know, it's owned by Warner Brothers and distributed by them, but he wanted more creative control over his music. And, of course, Frank did his own thing, didn't he?
Always.
Nobody's going to tell him no.
No, he was kind of the opposite of Jimi Hendrix when it came to singing. He would invite people to his recording sessions to watch.
Reprise label also featured Stevie Nicks, Lindsey Buckingham, Eric Clapton, Enya, Michael Bublé, Josh Groban, and Neil Young.
Ooh, some good stuff.
Some have come and gone, of course, but some... I'm not sure if the Reprise label's still around, but Warner Brothers is, yeah. So they had March of 1970, Band of Gypsies, recorded over a couple of nights in the end of December and early part of January 1970 at the Fillmore East.
Yeah, and that record is very interesting because everybody kind of points to it as to, after the experience, where was he going? And mm-hmm. that one seems to indicate that he had some other ideas that he was kind of fleshing out.
That was number five in the U.S. In late August 1970, his historical performances recorded at the Monterey Pop Festival. We talked about that.
Yeah.
With Monterey Pop, you know, they ABC bought the rights to show the movie for like $250,000, then saw the antics of Jimi Hendrix, which really were tame compared to today.
I mean, look at that. It's like, you know, it's like kids' hour, for God's sake, compared to what they'll put on today.
So ABC spent $250,000 for the rights to the movie and never aired it.
Exactly. And that that kid that was in the 17-year-old we talked about that was in the front row just happened to have one more picture to take, and he got, of course, the famous lighting of the fire.
The Jimi Hendrix antics.
Stand next to your fire.
He performed, that was side one of the Monterey Pop Festival, those historic performances recorded and released. Otis Redding performance was all a side two.
Yeah.
You remember, I talked about that at the Monterey, how Otis Redding was one of the only black performers there along with Jimmy.
Mm-hmm.
Motown performers were not really welcome there. Barry Gordy did not want them there.
Yes.
And so Otis Redding brought the house down. He did a very good job. He hadn't been, I don't even think he'd been out west before.
If you ever want to listen to some good playing and singing, that's the record you want. I know that Woodstock's a good one, and there are other good pop festivals, but boy, that was really, it was a controlled environment. There were only about 10,000 people there. It wasn't one of these crazy 3 or 4 day yeah. exercises in futility. Mm-hmm. It was, you know, it was all about the artists.
And the music, yeah.
Yes.
The Cry of Love came out following his death in March of 71, recorded in early 1970, featured new material that Jimmy was working on at the time for his fourth studio album. It had Freedom, it had Nightbird Flying an Angel on it. I wonder what he would have been as an artist in the 70s. Do you think he would have been into disco, or would he might have gotten more reflective like Marvin Gaye or something?
That's the problem, is that we have no idea. Would he have gone the way of Sly and Sly Stone, who kind of gave up on the whole thing, you know, with the whole disco, or would he have ended up in Vegas, you know?
Yeah.
You don't have any clue where he was going. But from what I've heard on some of those records, I think there were things that he was looking at. And I think he would have been very interested in things like rap and things like hip-hop. And it might have been something that he could have really worked with.
Yeah, he might have been one of the early hip-hop artists or
exactly.
something, for all we know, Sugar Hill
exactly.
Gang and whatever. You know, he played the Isle of Wight Festival in 1970 and lost his life to an accidental death September 17th. Mm. It's terrible.
Yeah, it is. And it's funny, you asked me before kind of what would be your dream lineup with Jimi Hendrix in there. And at the time, I did say, you know, I'd love to see Hendrix with kind of the San Francisco crew of Santana mm-hmm. and Jefferson Airplane.
Yeah.
But I did look up, and just a couple of months before he died, in fact, July 17th, 1970, had you been in New York City, you could have gone to Randall's Island and seen Steppenwolf, Jethro Tull,
mm-hmm.
Grand Funk Railroad, with the headliner, Jimi Hendrix, for
$8.50. That would have been a good show
and
to see, huh?
And that actually happened? That's not something I invented out of my mind or anything like that. That happened at Randall's Island in New York.
Actual bill.
So, wow. Wouldn't that have been something to see?
Yeah. You know, he was in the Army and was discharged a year later.
Yes, absolutely.
Didn't start playing guitar until age 15. You know, he moved from his home to Clarksville. Maybe he took the last train to Clarksville. Maybe that's why he hooked up with the Monkees.
Could
he was
have
familiar
been.
With the song somehow. And
absolutely.
He went off to Nashville, became a member of a backing band for the Isleys, and later with Little Richard in the mid-60s. So
yeah.
He had some good background behind him, didn't he?
He certainly did. He knew how to work in a studio. That's what he learned from some of these masters,
mm-hmm.
the way to get in a studio and make a record. And, you know, that would really behoove him to do later on in his career.
Yeah, Chas Chandler of the Animals became his manager after Jimmy moved to England. Things started taking off for him right away. Hey Joe, Purple Haze, Wind Cries Mary, all big hits across the pond. Then, of course, Monterey, and he was on his way. He became the world's highest paid performer in 1969 and performed that legendary Star Spangled Banner at Woodstock. But as you said, people had kind of given up on the weekend. They were cold and tired and rained on and hungry.
Yeah, if you've ever seen the movie when he does that, there literally can't be more than 10 or 20,000 people there out of a crowd that was 500,000. So you can imagine what it looked like.
I wonder at Woodstock what it must have been like searching for your Volkswagen Beetle or whatever, trying to find, I don't know where I parked. It was Friday.
It was Friday and it's rained and, you know, how would you find it? We wouldn't have GPS or anything like that.
So if
you're not somewhere where you know you're at, I mean, most of those people had never been anywhere near Woodstock before. So it's not like they knew, okay, I go down to the grocery store and I make a left and there's my car. Yeah,
to the Mickey Mouse aisle
exactly.
over here.
Exactly.
There weren't any shuttles to take you there.
I think a lot of it would have been trial and error.
it would have been easier to find your car at Blossom, probably.
Oh, absolutely.
So, at least it was daytime when they were looking for their car, most likely.
That's true.
Jimi Hendrix with the Jimi Hendrix Experience. It was a nice conversation we had. Frank, thanks for joining me.
It was great to be here and fun to talk about Jimi.
Next week, right on the 4th of July is when the show will be released, and we're going to talk about an all-American group named the Beach Boys. Should be fun, right here on Tim Friedman's 70s Rock Conversations. We'll see you then.